The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for May 6, 2017. With the start of National Bike Month and the 2017 National Bike Challenge, I wanted to impart some information that might give you some extra incentive to be the exemplary cyclist out on the roads, the one who backs away from danger and obeys all the rules. Back in February, Bicycling Magazine asked readers to weigh in on a safety survey and received 5,325 responses. The results are both interesting and disturbing. 41% of those who pedal four or more days a week have been hit. 61% of urban riders have been doored. 66% observe distracted drivers on most or every ride. 52% of women say they experience aggressive driver behavior on at least some of their rides, while 33% of men say the same. The survey has a lot more questions and answers and can be found at bicycling.com/enough-state-of-safety. Statistically, two cyclists are killed each day at the hands of drivers. Don't be one of them. Be an advocate for safe cycling. I also want to take a moment to acknowledge the tragic loss of Axon Hagen's Berman rider, Chad Young. In the effort to catch the pack, Chad and two other riders were chasing at the Tour of the Gila in New Mexico when they crashed on a descent. Chad could not recover from his injuries and passed away this past Friday. Our deepest condolences go out to his family, friends, and teammates. Chad was only 21. There is a lovely tribute to him on cyclingnews.com from the head soigneur, Reed McCalvin, from April 30th. It will give you a glimpse into who Chad was and why he will be so missed by everyone. Let's move on to this week's show. As promised, we have a twofer. My first guest is the Reverend Laura Everett. Laura ministers her congregants in Boston. Reading her Meet Me section on her blog, Rev Everett, Laura says, quote, I move in between my work as a pastor, an unabashed urbanist, and a bicycle evangelist. Laura became a committed year-round cyclist when her car died on the side of the road and her rescue team were all cyclists. From her experiences on the bike as well as her experience as a pastor, she wrote the book Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. The book takes the bicycle piece by piece, from frame to fork to wheels and gears, and juxtaposes it to life from an urban and religious perspective. It's beautifully written. It makes you think. After a short break, we're going to speak with the family-owned and operated business that is stepping up its Steel 2 production right here in Ohio. Verywald's Caitlin Axeloff and her husband Chris Vorwald join me to talk about their company and how they have prepared to renew their commitment to the bicycle tubing market with the hopes of offering a better product in the form of air-hardened steel and stainless tubes. Finally, our second half of the twofer books comes from one of the funniest, most irreverent, and interesting retired pro riders who ever raced a bike. Phil Guymon's pro cycling dreams were not fulfilled, and in facing the music, he left the sport. But not exactly. Phil was writing the Ask a Pro column for Velo News, and if you can imagine the kinds of questions people might just ask a professional cyclist, he just couldn't resist compiling some of those questions and turning them into his new book, Ask a Pro, Deep Thoughts and Unreliable Advice from America's Foremost Cycling Sage. The title pretty much gives you the flavor for the book anyway. But there is substance to Phil, too, and we pry it out of him. He loves cookies, by the way. We talk about that, too. So here we go. Our first stop is Boston, Massachusetts, to speak with Reverend Laura Everett about her new book, Holy Spokes. Hello, Laura. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Hi.
How are you? How's Boston?
Oh, Boston is a bit cold and gray, but I had a nice commute in anyway. Thanks for asking. The snow's gone and people are starting to come out.
Yes, well, everybody's out here. It is green and flowering and beautiful in Northeast Ohio, and now it's humid. So we go from one extreme to another. So, you know, I have the opportunity to review a lot of books about cycling. I mean, everything you could possibly imagine. Mm-hmm. And your book, your new book, Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels, has to be one of the more unique and authentic books I've ever read.
Thank you. That's lovely. I appreciate speaking to another cyclist about this. I've been hoping that I could tell this story in a way that cyclists could respond to.
Well, I think maybe they will. Before we actually delve into sort of the meat of the book, let my listeners get a sense of who you are. Give us some of your background and your professional work and how you came to be an urban cyclist, which is an interesting story in and of itself.
I'm a cycling convert. I grew up in the suburbs of New Jersey, and we rode our bicycles as kids for recreation, but not much for transit. Maybe we'd ride our bicycles to go visit a neighbor or go to the park, but it wasn't a regular part of my life. I grew up in a suburban area where cars were simply a fact of life. I moved to Boston to go to grad school, actually to go to seminary. My first day of seminary was September 11th, 01. I thought I'd be a local church pastor, and about midway through, decided that I really loved working with a wide range of people, not just from one tradition, and moved into the work of working with intra-Christian and interfaith relations. And so I began working for the Massachusetts Council of Churches about 12 years ago. So that's how I got to Boston. And Boston is a city where we have a lot of people who cycle through quickly because we have so many colleges and universities, and then we have old families who have been here a long, long time. So part of my story as a converted cyclist is about becoming a Bostonian, what it takes to really become from somewhere. And without a doubt, my bicycle has made me committed to this city, committed to my neighborhood, committed to my neighbors, and actually have a sense of how these disparate neighborhoods connect. And my conversion to becoming a regular four-season commuting cyclist came on the side of the highway, or at least it started, the side of the highway on 93 North. I had finished seminary. I was working for this Christian institution, and my car died. This beater, I think it was a 96 Jetta, died along the side of the road. And I happened to be in a Bible study at that time with some other young adults who were asking real questions about our faith and our personal finances. These were folks who were convinced that Jesus said a whole lot more about money than about anything that was being debated in the culture wars, and so we were opening up our checkbooks to one another. It's one of the most vulnerable things I've ever done. And I went to that Bible study the week after my car died, and these friends said, "You can't afford a new car. What are you doing?" And they were right. I couldn't. I really couldn't afford a new car. And it happened that some of the women in that Bible study were cyclists. And we took $100. I bought a frame off of someone's old roommate, and one of the women in that Bible study built up my first single speed. It was a Fuji Club bike, and that started my everyday cycling.
interesting beginnings. And obviously how it has integrated into your life in a lot of different ways is also quite interesting. We're going to talk more about your book, but you do a lot of advocacy in addition to your regular church work. Tell us a little bit about your activism, because it's very cycling centric in some ways.
Well, and I think you and your listeners probably have a real keen sense of this too, that cycling and our built environment brings up all sorts of questions. My experience was that it was a pretty short route between riding a bicycle daily and advocacy. I realized how quickly the roads, as they're currently configured, don't support multimodal use and vulnerable parties. At the time that I started cycling regularly as my primary mode of transit, there was a group forming here in Boston called the Boston Cyclists Union, our city-level advocacy group, and I started volunteering. I'm good at talking to strangers. It's one of the things a pastor learns how to do well. And so I would work with the Cyclists Union to staff tables at farm stands or neighborhood farmers markets and talk to folks to try to find out who was actually riding and what their needs were. I've been a part of bicycle counts. I've been a part of advocacy just in my own neighborhood when we were arguing for protected bike lanes. And I think the justice issues about whose safety we prioritize and who we extend concern to and institutional and civic support to are part of the advocacy work I've been doing, in part because as Boston, like many cities, has seen a real boom in practical cycling, commuters, kids, and a bike share system, we've seen that our infrastructure hasn't caught up to it. I feel like I've experienced this and am well equipped to advocate to my city and state officials. And as someone who has helped when there's been a crash and even a fatality, that always spurs a kind of activism, because those deaths are completely and utterly unnecessary if we attend to our built environment more intentionally.
I have a question that I didn't, so everybody knows I send questions ahead of time so that nobody's blindsided by the kind of crazy things I ask. Do you know Richard Fries?
Oh, yeah.
From MassBike? Yeah. Okay. So I figured, how could you not, right? How could you not know Richard?
Yeah. You know, Richard and I have worked together with another colleague, Joel, on a ride of silence. We've worked together on some advocacy. There was a cyclist killed in one of the Boston suburbs that Richard knew through some longer rides, a sort of weekend riders, and Richard and I worked together on that ghost bike ceremony as well. So yeah, I know Richard. He does good advocacy.
He does. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Laura Everett. What is your title? Are you Reverend Laura Everett?
I am.
That's what I thought, because I know your Twitter handle is Rev Everett or Rev something like
Rev
that.
Rev Everett, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The book is Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. And that's what we're going to talk about right now, because it's such an interesting book. It's not probably what you're thinking when we talk about spirituality. We're not really talking about specifically religious issues here. I found it sort of an allegorical perspective of the bicycle and bicycling as it applies to you personally. So when did you start looking at your bicycle in spiritual terms?
That's a great question.
Thanks.
I think when I started cycling, it was maybe a spiritual hurdle and a challenge to risk and step out in faith that something I had never done before was something that I could do, and that people who had gone before me could teach me how to do that. In religious communities, folks will talk about that as formation or discipleship, but I had cycling Sherpas that taught me how to ride in a city. There were about four women, it happened, who taught me the route to my office. We tried it on a Saturday. They led me through the city, taught me where to stop, how to signal, what to pack, what to wear, all these things that I didn't know. So I think my thinking about my bicycle in spiritual terms came pretty quickly. And really, it was getting to know the wider cycling community here in Boston that helped some of these ideas congeal. Maybe your readers experience this too, but cyclists are passionate. They are evangelists. If you ask, why do you ride a bicycle, they'll tell you and want to make sure that you're getting on one too. And I thought, gosh, I know the zeal of the convert.
It's true.
You know, it's the good life on two wheels. Why wouldn't we want to share that good news with everyone, right?
Right. Tell us about Brother Lawrence.
Sure. Well, as I was trying to make spiritual sense of this new thing in my life, I turned to one of the classics of spiritual writing. So in the winter of 1632, there's a young man named Nicholas Herman, and he had a conversion experience. He's in the middle of France, and in the dead of winter, he looks at a barren tree and sees the possibilities of spring. So Brother Lawrence is a monk. He spent a great majority of his life peeling potatoes, working in the monastery kitchen. But his writings would be collected and be turned into a book called The Practice of the Presence of God, which is a real classic in Christian spiritual writing. And I turned to Brother Lawrence. It was a book I had read as a young woman, but turned to him again as I was trying to think about the spiritual practice of cycling, because he doesn't absent himself from the world. He doesn't, despite being in a monastery, he sort of lives with the clatter of pans and the annoying habits of other brothers and the monotony of peeling potatoes. And that everyday spirituality is part of what I think cyclists know. So in religious communities, we sometimes talk about orthodoxy being shared belief and orthopraxis being shared or common practice. My sense is cyclists are orthopraxis. We get up, we ride, we pull our bicycle out, we lock it, we go back, we do it again. And my experience is that what we do daily shapes us. And I wanted to spend some time examining how the regular practice of riding a bicycle formed me spiritually.
So we dissect the bicycle and relate it piece by piece to life. And the first chapter is titled Frame, Rule of Life. So the reader can really begin to get the essence of your perspective right from the first chapter. You go back to basics explaining bicycle frames, how the first bicycles influenced life for both men and women, and then talk about how the frame is a rule of life. So if you just can sort of go through chapter one like that, I think people will begin to understand how the book unfolds. So can you explain that for us?
Yeah. And I did want to start with the basics because I have an evangelistic mission, too. I want more people on bicycles. And I thought, if there are people of some faith or no faith who pick up this book because they're interested in sort of the spirituality of everyday life, I wanted the information about bicycles to be basic enough that people who don't ride yet could access this. So your cyclist readers probably know that the shifting shape of bicycle frames has really formed how we ride. So we ride on 1890s technology in a lot of ways. But even things like gender show up early in bicycles. The idea that a woman's bike or a step-through frame would be so structured that we'd still be riding with those presumptions about women's skirts and not wanting to spread one's legs wide, even 100 years later. But the idea of the frame as a rule of life, so each chapter is paired with a part of a bicycle and what I'm calling an urban spiritual discipline. Monastic communities would use the term a rule of life to mean a set of patterns or norms that govern their communal living. So you first start to get monastic communities in Egypt among the Christians there in the 3rd and 4th century. And so that term, a rule of life, comes from the Latin regula. And while it's not especially trendy to talk about this word now, spiritual habits require discipline. And I think practical cyclists know this too. It's our discipline. You don't just go out and ride 100 miles, or at least I don't, but you need the regula, the discipline, the rule of life that builds you up and up and up. I think that's true in our spiritual lives too. What I started to notice about practical cyclists, those of us who ride our bicycles as primary transit, is that these cyclists have a rule of life too, a discipline that shapes their every decision, and that implicit rule is always by bike. And so the bicycle begins to orient our daily lives. So in each chapter, I try to toggle between some historical and experiential information about bicycles and what I think the sort of spiritual consequences of that metaphor might be.
So take gears and pacing and make those comparisons for us.
I had a therapist who once said to me that it seemed like I only had two speeds, on and off. There wasn't much in between that. And I think, unfortunately, she's right. And I've learned that for me to be a healthy and whole person, I need to use all of my gears. And so the information about what gears are and what they do and how we moved from direct drive in the early bicycles to using gears becomes a metaphor for the spiritual discipline of pacing. How do we move through our lives in a way at a constant cadence that allows us to ride over the bumps, use momentum when it's with us, stop fighting the resistance when it's going against us? Again, each chapter is about a part of the bicycle, an investigation of that part of the bicycle, where it comes from, why it's necessary, and then a reflection on the spiritual discipline. And I think to be healthy and whole people, we have to ask, am I going too fast? Am I running over people in the process? Or am I going so slowly that I don't actually get to where I need to go?
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Reverend Laura Everett. She has written a book called Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. It's a fascinating book, and it takes a very different look at cycling and the bicycle and who we are when we're riding it. So you do two special services. One is the Blessing of the Bicycles and the Ghost Bike Service. Tell us about those two.
Well, I think these are sort of a merger of the praxis of the cycling community, rituals that are indigenous and well grounded in the life of cyclists, and some of the best of what I know from being a part of a religious tradition, in my case, Christianity. But Christianity has a great practice of blessing objects of everyday life, whether it's blessing our animals with the Feast of St. Francis, or blessing bread that nourishes us, or blessing babies at the time of their birth or at a time of baptism. And here in Boston, we took inspiration from the Blessing of the Bicycles that I believe began in New York City. And every year on the first Friday of Bike Month, we hold a giant outdoor Blessing of the Bicycles. And why not, right? These are tools of our lives. I think cyclists have a really intimate relationship with this tool. And why not say that they're holy? Why not say that they're blessed? And so I've gathered with some other religious leaders in the city, myself as a cyclist, to hold a ceremony. We invite people to ride their bicycles to the front of one of our largest churches. We gather. We sing When the Saints Come Riding In. We read a bit from the book of Ezekiel, which tells the story of the wheels that turn with the movement of the Spirit. It's a great reading. And then I and some other religious leaders go around with a mix of holy oil and chain lube and bless bicycles and sometimes bless helmets, too.
Chain lube.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's in a totally official mix, but the cyclists get it. Right.
Yeah, I get it for sure. And so I assume that the Ghost Bike Service has to do with those bikes that have been placed around Boston in honor of those fallen cyclists.
That's right.
Yeah.
Again, I think the Ghost Bike ritual really came from the cycling community early in the 2000s in St. Louis, and then to Pittsburgh, and then New York. And I know for a long time in many places, ghost bikes went up under cover of night, often in defiance of the local civic officials. Here in Boston, we've built a closer relationship with the police department that's less antagonistic, and it's meant that we are working with city officials to commemorate the dead and be mindful of our built environment that has so much further to go to protect everyone. And so here in Boston, we essentially have a ghost bike guild, like a funeral guild, that prepares the bike, rides it to the location, chains it up. Other people work with the local police. Other work with the local media. I often work with the family and close friends of the dead. a graphic designer here designed a bulletin, and together we have a service of remembrance where we dedicate the ghost bike. I think it comes from a deep conviction among the community of cyclists that our lives matter and are worthy to be seen and worthy to be commemorated when people die, that we don't just take these crashes as the inevitability of transit, but a tragedy, and that we will make ourselves visible and we will make these ghost bikes visible until we come to that glorious vision of a day when all can ride safely.
Well, I have to say, Laura, you have written a very thought-provoking and informative and deeply thought-out book. I really enjoyed it, and I am not a religious person per se. I would say I'm a spiritual person, and every chapter brings out something in everyone, I think, and I can't imagine someone not enjoying it. It's also a very clearly written book, so there's nothing obscure about it. There's nothing really, you know, difficult to understand. It's very plainly written, and I really enjoyed it. And I thank you for writing it, because I don't think anybody else has approached bicycling exactly the way you have. Where can listeners get a copy of your book?
Well, I hope you ride to your local bookstore and ask them to carry it. Certainly you can get it from Amazon, but we're really excited to sell this through local bookstores. I'd invite folks to all.
The truth is, it isn't published yet.
It's just come out this week.
Oh, yes.
So
okay.
It should be available. You can order it through the website Erdmann's. That's the publisher, W.B.
Right.
Erdmann's. Wonderful place to get it. Amazon has it. And most of all, I ask that you ride to your local bookstore and ask them to carry it too.
Yes, that is nice, isn't it? There really are some local bookstores still around. Not too
it's
many,
true.
But they're worth supporting. Laura, thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today. I really enjoyed the conversation. And we will post a link to the book on Erdmann's, because I like to go right to the publisher if they prefer to have the author's book bought that way. And stay safe.
Thank you so much. Ride in joy, Diane.
I will. I will actually be in Boston in September. I'm coming for the Ballers ride.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
All right. Take care of yourself and have a great cycling season, which is year-round
Thank
for you.
Diane.
Alrighty.
Year-round.
Right. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Laura Everett joined me from her office in Boston, Massachusetts, the bicycling reverend. I really enjoyed talking with her. The book, again, is Holy Spokes, The Search for Urban Spirituality on Two Wheels. As Laura said, she would prefer that you would pick up a copy, if you want one, from a local bookshop. You can also get it from the publisher, William B. Erdmann, that's E-E-R-D-M-A-N-S, and from the other usual places if you are inclined to order online. We need to take a quick break. We'll be right back to speak with the people from Verywall in Columbiana, Ohio, about steel tubing. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to head on over to Columbiana, Ohio, and talk with Chris and Caitlin about Verywall, steel tubing for the bicycle industry. Hello, Chris and Caitlin. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
Well, I want to know about Verywall, about your company. With the absence of another American tube maker, which was very popular, True Temper, people were wondering what was going to happen, and here you are. Tell us about your company.
So our company has been around since 1985. It actually started with my dad and my grandpa in the basement of my parents' first home as a consulting firm. And then slowly it evolved into manufacturing. And then today, we specialize in creating variable wall thickness tubular products for a multitude of industries, including automotive, aerospace, and sporting goods, including bicycles. Specifically, we make aerospace seat beams, automotive link arms, aluminum baseball bats, air hardening seamless steel tubing, 4130 chromoly tubing, and aluminum tubing. For 30 years, our goal has been to be the go-to source for tubular components and to provide flexibility to meet the needs of customers in a variety of fields.
Okay, that's pretty succinct. I got it. So I want to stop at the seamless tubing part. I know a little bit about bike building, and I know, you know, just enough to get in trouble, I'm sure. And I know a little bit about frame building itself, not just the bike, but frame. That's where we're going to start. Are you hoping to produce a product that will indeed replace some of these True Temper tubes that are now not going to be made anymore for frame builders?
Yeah, in a way. So we've worked a lot with a number of different frame builders around the United States, some of the bigger names, and just trying to see what type of tube profiles that they've been using from True Temper, what would they change if, you know, to make those tubes that they were getting from True Temper kind of their ideal tubes. So a lot of builders were saying, oh, I could use such and such a tube, but ideally I would want, you know, a little bit longer butt on one side and maybe a shorter taper or something like that, or a longer center. And so we've worked with them to develop our current line of Thermalex products, really with the idea of filling a massive void in the market that True Temper is leaving by exiting. But at the same time, we really don't want to be viewed as just a True Temper replacement. We feel that we're providing a much higher quality product to the marketplace and really working more closely with frame builders than maybe True Temper was.
So will you be offering a custom tube? For example, Richard Sachs likes to have his tubes drawn to his specs. If XYZ frame builder came to you and said, I want a seamless high-performance steel tube and these are my specs, are you able to draw it the way they want?
It really depends on the specs, but eventually that's where we'd like to head, to work with some big manufacturers on specifics on their custom tubes. Now, that being said, if people are out there in the market and they reach out and say, hey, I want five of this customized tube, you know, maybe it, as far as cost, it's really not going to be feasible. But in terms of, in a perfect world, we'd love to serve everyone with their custom unique tube. And we really want to work with some of the larger players in the market to develop what they're using. But yes, we evaluate really everything when people are reaching out, whether it's a contact form or an email or a phone call, to discuss what their specific needs are and try to meet those needs as best we can.
One of the things I saw on your website, which really sort of intrigued me, was something called a thin wall practice tube. What is that?
Well, we had a number of people reach out on Instagram saying, oh, we're new to the game as far as frame building goes, and we just really don't want to be spending $50, $60 on a few tubes to try to weld them and kind of hone our skills with welding. And, you know, because if we mess it up, then we're out that $60, and now we got to go back to the manufacturer and spend another $60 just to try something again. We tried to meet their needs by saying, hey, we've got some things that we've, whether it's scrapped in different processes of, you know, the research and development stages, we have some material here that's thin wall that, you know, if you want to just get into frame building and you're new to the whole frame building scene, you can buy these tubes on our website and just hone in your welding skills. They're not designed to be really applicable for a full frame build. They're really just for people that are new to the game and want to practice their skills.
Well, you're using the word welding. Do you have a tube that could be brazed also, or would that be the same tube and it's just a choice of the builder?
It would be the same tube. It's really just the choice of the builder. Some people would rather braze and weld, but really our air hardening steel tubes will really react the same way as any other air hardening tube on the market as far as the brazing goes.
All right, you need to explain air hardening again, because it's been a while since I actually thought about it.
So the air hardening, during a welding process, you get a cool down, an air, you know, you let it cool down. You're not quenching it in anything. You're just allowing it to cool. The air hardening piece of this steel is that it'll actually strengthen at those weld joints as it air cools. So rather than actually getting any sort of weakness in that weld joint that you could see with other tubing, it actually strengthens. So it can take higher stress.
You know, I wanted to know, and I'm listening to all this stuff, and you are unbelievably knowledgeable. Are you an engineer, Chris?
That's a great question. Actually, I have only been working here at Very Wolf since last August. And prior to that, I was actually in investment management, managing retirement portfolios for high net worth clients. So as far as engineering background, I have very little.
But a good, quick learner, obviously.
It must be, if that's the feedback you're giving me.
I think, too, just being a family business, you know, Chris and I coming to work here at Very Well after our wedding was kind of to have a continuity plan. So all of our customers understood there's a future for the company and you know, so we could go out and bid other jobs and people could see a succession plan. So both of us kind of agreed if we left our corporate jobs in Cincinnati, we were either all in or not in at all. So he and I are often out there sanding the bike tubes, bagging them, doing the quality control ourselves just because we are 100% in this.
How many people work at Very Well? How many employees do you have?
We probably have about 50 people total. We work three different shifts, so there's people here round the clock. Just, you know, if there's one machine, then there's, you know, three different shifts that can run that machine.
It never occurred to me. Of course, it's a big machine shop, right?
Yeah, it is. So, yeah, all the machines here we actually developed in-house. So my dad and grandpa are both engineers, metallurgical engineers. So, you know, studying all the metals, and then they've done all the design work for all the machines here. So this past year we just added another draw bench, which just gave us the capability to really be able to tackle this whole steel market. So that was a big investment and commitment for our company, just to say, you know, we're going to domestically provide all of these steel tubes.
What kind of feedback are you getting from the industry right now, the bicycle industry? Obviously, you work in other industries, too.
We've heard great feedback. So, you know, Chris Muller at S&M Bikes kind of pulled us back initially into the bike market and just said, hey, guys, you know, I'm having difficulty with quality and delivery of, you know, the previous vendor. Will you guys step back in and do all of the, you know, tubing that we have? Because we had still supplied handlebar material to S&M, so we've always had a relationship with them. It was just getting pulled back into this whole air hardening market is what initially drove us in. And then, you know, everybody's been saying our tubes are pretty straight. They're clean on the inside. They have a nice polish. We did go to Philly Bike Show this past year. We didn't have a booth, but we just walked around with some samples to start to talk to builders. And then we were at NABS, too. So I think a lot of it is, you know, the uncertainty of Very Well. Even though we've been around for 30-plus years, the smaller builders didn't necessarily know about us. Our company had actually never been to a trade show before, so Philly was the first time of walking around, and then NABS was the first time we ever had a booth. So it was a lot for us, you know, to get the backdrop and the floor and the display boards and the tubes and even just shipping it out there.
Oh, it is not an inexpensive proposition to go to a trade show. In fact, it's insane.
Yeah.
As a vendor. Oh.
Yeah, we actually already signed up for a booth at Philly this year. So after NABS, we were like, all right, we have all this stuff, we're going.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, let's use this stuff. Well,
how can
my listeners find out more about Very Well?
They can actually just go to our website. If they're looking at purchasing tubing or finding out more about our history in the bicycle market specifically, they can head to shop.very-wall.com.
Well, it's really nice to have a company in Ohio that is serving the bicycle industry, and it's been wonderful to talk with you. I wish you a lot of luck, and I'll bet you guys do really, really well.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, we're looking forward to serving this market, so thank you for your time.
All right. Well, have a wonderful rest of your day. Thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Chris and Caitlin join me from Very Wall. It's VARI-WALL.com. And you can order a practice tube. I think that's such a cool idea to perfect some of your welding techniques. We need to take another quick break, and we will be back to talk with Phil Guymon. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit doddcamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Outspoken Cyclist, as promised. Here's our second of the twofer book reviews, and we get to talk with Phil Guymon. Hi, Phil. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me, and thanks for writing a great new book. It's titled Ask a Pro, Deep Thoughts and Unreliable Advice from America's Foremost Cycling Sage. As usual, all tongue-in-cheek, Phil. How have you been?
I've been good. It's been a weird 6 months or so, but we're adjusting.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I'm not racing anymore, and it's strange.
Yeah, that's true.
It's a life shift, but I haven't gotten fat yet. And, no complaints.
Are you still
no
eating complaints. Cookies?
Yeah.
Just making sure. So yeah, then you're still riding a bike, too.
Yeah, all that stuff. I've been doing all that. Just got to be a little more careful. It's been interesting, but I have a lot of fun projects and to distract me from whatever could be sad.
Well, you know, you went from this kind of guy who just showed up at the races and started winning to a guy who went pro, got onto a pro team, went to Europe, and then a year later just said, never mind. But I don't think it was exactly like that. So why did you decide to quit as a pro racer?
Well, I didn't exactly decide. Like, it was kind of decided for me, and I just didn't fight it.
Got it.
It wasn't what I planned, and I was definitely, like, begging for contracts from teams and the usual thing. But at the end, I didn't really get anything that was worth taking, and I didn't want to, like, try to hang on to something that was sort of in between. Those were sort of my options. I didn't really have any great options. The right decision was to hang it up, which I see now, but at the time, it wasn't fun. It's still, like, an adjustment.
How old are you now?
31.
So you still have lots of career ahead of you.
Well, on the bike, no.
No, not on the bike, but in your life.
Yeah. I still have adulthood ahead of me.
Well, maybe.
Which is kind of my thing is, like, it's time to get going with that. Let's see which direction I have a future in. And it obviously wasn't the bike. Even if I could have raced another year for a small team or 4 years, it seemed like, you know, it's time to get on with it.
Let me ask you a real quick question about the hindsight you have in pro cycling. If you could give advice to any young rider who's looking at cycling as a quote-unquote career as a pro, what might you tell him or her that he may or she may not find out until, you know, you kind of get mired in it?
I mean, that's sort of what my books have been about, kind of, is just like, here's what you think you're going for, and then here's what it actually is. And I have a third book coming out in October that's sort of that with the world tour. My thing was like, okay, you know, I'm 23, I'm on Jelly Belly, it's going to be great, I'm a pro. And then it's like, nah, you're still living out of your car. It's not what you expect. And I think, like, being realistic about what that life is going to be, and then you have to know how much you want it. So my thing was always like, there are a lot of people that I met 2 years later than I could have that ended up helping me or sort of showing me the reality. Getting out of your little world, I would say, would be a big bit of advice for kids. Like, find someone who knows who's where you want to be and see what that is.
Wow, that's a great piece of advice. Really a great piece of advice. So as you were writing the new book, Ask a Pro, because your first book, Cycling on $10 a Day, I think it was?
Mm-hmm.
I actually still have that book available on my website because I thought it was one of the better books that was ever written. It's great. I love your perspective.
Thank you.
I love your sense of humor, which I think to move on in this world, you better have one because the world's really weird right now.
Right. Yeah. This is how we get through it. We laugh at it.
Exactly. You actually said some things that evidently other people were telling you not to say, like, don't tell people about that. Don't tell people about that. Did you piss anybody off?
Probably.
Oh, good. What kinds of
I don't know. Anytime I pissed somebody off, it was either like accidental and that's kind of their fault if they decided to get pissed off, or they were wrong and it was calculated, or at least I wasn't worried about pissing them off. No, I mean, I think there's a lot of mystique of pro cycling. There's a lot of I would say, you know, oh, you're a pro athlete, it's a glorious life. And it's kind of like, yes, there's part of that, but there's also, it's not really. Here's what it's really like. And it's, I think a lot of people were sort of insulted when I was like, no, it sucked that I had to do Paris-Roubaix. Like, it wasn't, that was basically telling me, like, my career was done, and I didn't feel like the glory you're supposed to there, and that's the reality, and I'm telling you how I felt. Like, it was special to have that number and to be there, but it wasn't a life-affirming achievement for me. It was a failure, you're a climber, come do this thing, and we're throwing you to the wolves. And I think, like, that kind of stuff, like, sort of being honest about how things felt and how things actually were when you're in Paris-Roubaix, it's not a glorious march, it's a circus. It's drunk Dutch people and Belgian people, like, wandering in the street in front of you if you're not in the first 10 dudes. And so I think saying that sort of would piss some people off. But it's, you know, it's my experience. I tell my truth.
Well, let's start with the premise of Ask a Pro. It didn't actually start out as a book. Wasn't it a question and answer thing on the Velo News site?
Exactly. Yeah, it was in the magazine. It was the first thing that I was ever like actually hired to write. So it was kind of like it was very meaningful to me that way. It was the first time anybody paid me to write something was that column. And it was funny when the book came out. Neil Rogers was editing Velo News when I pitched it, and so I kind of thanked him when the book came out, and he dug through and found the original pitch for the article, which I was 23 and I was on Jelly Belly and just like desperate to make some use of the English degree I just finished.
Right.
And I just sent him this proposal, and I was asking him to, you know, here's the idea I have, here's a sample. I kind of just made up an Ask a Pro article, and I was asking him to pay me in free advertising for the little clothing company that I was working on the side. And I was like, this poor desperate kid. Like, I was reading my own thing, like, God, I can't believe that. I mean, that was absolutely me. That's how, like, I was just grasping at straws.
Yeah, but see, I see that as being very entrepreneurial, that you had the guts to go out and do that.
Yeah, well, I probably sent 1,000 of those emails, and one person was like, yeah, I'll take a risk on Phil. And then 8 years later, it's a book. It's sort of, it's pretty amazing, really.
That's all it took, one person.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what people can learn from that, but that was the reality. So this column, like, the premise would be kind of like, when you're a pro, everyone there's this mystique. There's like, oh, what's it like to be a pro? And I would get the same questions over and over from amateurs, from friends. It's just a very complicated sport. When someone gets on a bike, there's like nothing's intuitive about it, you know, from how the bike fits to, you know, this crazy array of equipment. And then, you know, what do you eat on the bike? And then there's stuff that, like, once you do it for a while, there's stuff that's so obvious and it's so second nature that it's easy for me, and you kind of want to share that with people. And because I ride around in LA or something, and I just see everybody's doing it wrong. And if you just tap them on the shoulder, be like, no, like, you know, raise your seat a mile. Don't eat that, you know, like that kind of stuff. And it's just, like, it's available. Like, there's really obvious stuff. And it was sort of nice to have like a place to put some of those things, that if people wanted to find it, it was available. Then over the years, people keep asking the same question, because, yeah, I answered that in 2011
right.
In the magazine you didn't get. So, yes, you're still asking me. So the idea was kind of like, once I wasn't a pro anymore, I was going to obviously not keep writing the Ask a Pro column. But it'd be cool to like put it all together, have it in this book. So it's got my silly little answers and my sarcasm, and then. And then there is some like useful, fun advice that I think would help the average person. I pepper real advice in with making fun of whoever asked it.
We're going to actually do a question answer thing from the book in a moment. But I want to remind our listeners, we're speaking with Phil Guymon. He is, I guess I have to say, an ex-pro rider now. He was a pro rider.
I'm retired.
A retired. Oh, I like that much better. A retired
right.
Pro rider. Much more appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So let's give the listeners the flavor of the book. I have the book in front of me, and I'm going to read a question, and I want you to give us your answer so people can get a flavor of how much fun this book is. So the question was, after a ride in the rain, I use a paintbrush to wipe away the dirt. Is that a good practice? Is there a better trick? And you say...
I don't remember what I said.
Oh, well, it's on page 17. You say, I used to make the same mistake. For years, I used various brushes, soaps, and degreasers. They got the bike clean, but it was a lot of work. And I finally stumbled onto a much easier solution. Just be a pro so you can hook your bike onto the rack by the team trailer, forget about it, and go get your massage.
It will be magically clean the next day. Sometimes I find a new chain, fresh bar tape, and even full bottles of ice-cold water to drink or drink mix. It's a lot like the Tooth Fairy. It doesn't make much sense if you think about it, but it always works out.
Yeah, I think that's sound advice. That's helpful, right? Everybody can use that advice.
Exactly. I'm going to give you the next one, which I had. The question was, I've noticed that when I wear my team kit, local Cat 2 racers wave at me, but when I wear something mismatched, they stare straight ahead. Why is that? Just tell me off the top of your head, why is that?
Bike riders are kind of dicks. It's something that I've noticed. When I was wearing my pro kit, I'd get a lot more waves than when I'm wearing like a black jersey or a cookie jersey or something. The waves are few and far between. People need to be more friendly, and everyone who rides a bike is doing it right. Everyone's like, there's this weird little competition when you ride past somebody on a bike, like suddenly they're racing you. And everybody needs to knock it off and go have fun. That's very far from the answer I had in the book, I'm sure.
Actually, I don't think you used the exact same vernacular, but it's not.
Well, I might have said dicks and they edited it, you know?
Oh, that could be. I don't know.
Yeah.
But since we can say that, that's not one of the forbidden words on the air, so who cares, right?
Good. Okay,
exactly.
Yeah. It was funny when we agreed to kind of put this book out, you know, Velen is kind of found all my old columns and collected. So the idea was like, I took the old articles that I wrote and, you know, I would edit them again and I'd kind of go back through and collect them and either categorize it. We had to sort of figure that out. But a lot of them, I was kind of like, what was I talking about? This is a stupid answer. And I would like completely change it. Or I would add in the book, there's a lot of like footnotes that I added in present, making fun of myself. So nobody's safe. I make fun of the reader. I make fun of me at 24. So it's also like a little more fun bonus kind of content for people who might have actually read the column when it came out. So there's new stuff in there.
Well, here's another great question. I'm just getting into cycling. What would you recommend for a newbie? And you start out, that's great to hear. I remember how confusing it was when I started out. So I think I can help you avoid some of the pitfalls. And one of the funniest is, if you have kids, take a picture of yourself so they don't forget what you look like. Upgrade your phone plan so you can call them between intervals. And next, if your place has white carpet, go ahead and paint black streaks on it. It's going to look like that from grease stains in a few months anyway. So it's,
yeah. And then the other one is you should get maroon sheets. I found is helpful because you're going to bleed on your sheets at some point.
Oh,
if you get maroon.
Oh, that's really
gross.
It
won't stain.
Yeah.
You're a step ahead of it.
You're ahead of it. Okay. So what kinds of things do team owners and managers not want the public to know?
I think in general, like, they sort of try to maintain this, the mystique that this is a professional sport, that this is a high budget kind of thing and everything's organized. And it's just not. It's just like, you know, it's not the NBA. We're sharing hotel rooms and bunk beds at the Tour de France sometimes those guys are in. And that's all. I think it's not the glory and the organized thing. It's everybody's kind of just in it. And, you know, it's bland buffets at French restaurants or in French hotels.
So it doesn't have the glamour.
No, it doesn't. It's not a pro sport like you think it is. And that's part of what makes it great is that nobody's really in it for the money because there's not that much money. And you actually have to love it that much more to put yourself through that or to go through that. And then you're able to sort of find the joy in it with your teammates or with whatever else.
So what are you going to be doing this season since you're not racing your bike?
Well, it's a weird thing. It took me a while to sort of figure out how I wanted to treat riding a bike. A lot of guys retire from racing or they're kicked out of the sport as I was. And they're kind of like, they don't want to see a bike again. I found myself to be the complete opposite of that. I love riding my bike and, you know, I'm real grumpy if I don't get to. And I like having goals and I like, you know, training and not just riding. So, you know, some of each, like I need that balance. So I kind of started a weird little mission. And I also like, I have my Fondo, which I want to keep growing and continue. And I have the two books coming out this year. The other one comes out in October. So I wanted to sort of stay relevant and keep doing things that fire me up and kind of keep having fun on the bike. I didn't want to ever lose that. So I started this worst retirement ever is what I'm calling it. It's a YouTube channel where the idea is I wasn't good enough to race anymore. And now I'm really bad at retiring as well. And so I'm going for basically for hill climb records or for Strava segments, whatever you want to consider it. And so I sort of had whatever sponsors I wanted. I kind of just contacted people who I, you know, or companies that I liked or always wanted to use. And, you know, they all gave me a little budget and I got a camera guy. So I fly around or road trip and I just go for hill climb record with, you know, I've got a Cannondale that's 13.6 pounds and I got like a speed suit. So I'm just going for, like, no one's ever tried to set a hill climb record with all that geeky stuff. There's a lot of been professional cyclists who go fast uphill, like Tom Daniel would, you know, in training for a stage race would go fast up a hill. No one's ever just specialized in that corner of cycling. So I'm doing that, and it's like a little YouTube show. So we're doing 10 episodes this year.
That's great.
And it's been a ton of fun. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you call it?
It's called Worst Retirement Ever.
Oh, that's right. Worst Retirement Ever. Oh, we'll have to go, like,
so we have two
that down.
We've filmed 5 episodes, and we have 2 that are up now, and we're kind of editing the other ones.
Very cool.
But by the end of the year, there'll be 10. It's been, it's, you know, the pitfalls of kind of, like, taking Strava seriously. It's not really a thing to be, like, a professional Strava rider.
Right.
But I'm trying to, like, take it seriously as much as I can, and it's fun, like, it doesn't work out that well at times.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, but it's like, it wouldn't be fun if I just went around and got every climb I was going for.
Right.
So it's been a little drama in the first 2 episodes as people are up to speed, but we'll see if I settle in and actually get 1 or 2 this year. It would be fun.
That would be fun. You have any predictions on who might be going to win the Giro?
Man, I don't even look. It's weird. I don't even... I have a weird relationship with racing now. Like, I like to ride my bike hard, but, like, the last thing I want to do is sign up for, like, a Criterium or something. I don't know why that is.
Oh, well.
And the second to last thing I want to do is watch a bike race. The caveat being if I think a friend can win.
Okay.
So, I don't know. None of my buddies are in line for the Giro. But, you know, I was watching Liège to see how Mike Woods did and to see Alex Howes in there. Like, that still fires me up. It's more for them than, like, being a fan of the sport. But I don't really give a shit about the Tour de France. I'd be stoked if, you know, if I'm watching Ian Boswell and Andrew Talance to battle it out at the Tour of California.
Okay.
That's sort of what I'm interested in at this point.
Well, I have one more question and then we're going to pitch the book again. Where are the best cookies in America?
In the book, in the inside cover on the front, there's a map of my favorite cookies. And it's more like the cycling-friendly cookies as well. That's a factor. There's a lot of, like, little cafes that I've discovered or that have discovered me where, you know, the owner's a cyclist and they give a bike discount, or they're, like, in a certain cycling-friendly location and they kind of own that. So, like, at the top of Mount Lemmon is the Cookie Cabin, which, like, it's not really a great cookie, but it's the top of Mount Lemmon. So if you climb Mount Lemmon, you have to eat it.
Got it.
And it's great for its what it lacks in quality, it makes up for in size, which is actually flawed logic, but somehow it works when you're there. It's more of a chocolate chip pancake than a cookie. I don't need to go on about that. But so there's that. And then in the front cover of the book, there's this map, and you can kind of refer to that. But Jekyll Island, Georgia, has a cookie that is, I would call that my favorite. And part of that is because, like, I grew up in the summers, I'd go there with my family, and that was, like, a cookie I had with my dad every morning when I was a kid. So there's, like, a sentimental aspect to it. So if you didn't grow up there having cookies with your dad, then the best cookie probably is at M Street Kitchen in Santa Monica, or any one of my friend Jeff's. He has a bunch of restaurants. So there's one in Chicago called Summer House, and then there's one in Hollywood called Stella Barra, and they all have the same cookie in the little glass inside, and it's pretty insane. My favorite one that he has, he'll make, like, Rice Krispie treats, and then he'll press them into the top of the chocolate chip cookie, like, before it comes out. So the little cubes of Rice Krispie treats are scattered inside. It's diabolical what he does. So Jeff has, like, a cooking show, and he's just been, like, he's a cyclist, and he's, like, become a really good friend. He's part of the reason I put on the Fondo is because he volunteered to make the cookies for it. So we have, like, a celebrity chef making cookies for all of our riders.
Well, don't we have that recipe at the back of the book?
Yeah, so that's, you could try to make it yourself. You don't have Jeff's magic touch.
Of course not.
But you can do real well with the recipe back there. Well, nobody does. Nobody who's reading it. And if you hang out at his restaurant, you're like, oh, I've been back there when the cookies are getting made. And he's, you know, there's a lot of scales and chemistry going on back there that I can't comprehend. But yeah, there is a cookie recipe that Jeff provided that a couple people have tried so far, and they've enjoyed it. So you certainly can't go wrong.
Well, the book is Ask a Pro, Deep Thoughts and Unreliable Advice from America's Foremost Cycling Sage, Phil Guymon. He also authored Pro Cycling on $10 a Day, which was one of my favorite books before this one. Now this one's becoming one of my favorite books. Do you have a title for book number 3?
Book number 3 is called Draft Animals.
Oh, cool.
and then the subtitle. So it's Draft Animals, Living the Pro Cycling Dream Once in a While.
As usual,
so
a
it's
great
sort of the
title.
Story of right. So it's being in the world tour and sort of like I thought I achieved my dreams, and then it turned out like no, I still had to carve out my own happiness from that, and that's sort of the message I learned as becoming an adult, and that I expressed that in the form of here's what it's like to really be in the world tour, and here's what these guys are like, and here's what I took from it, and eventually made it work as it was spitting me out.
Well, I'll tell you what, don't ever completely grow up because you're having fun, and I think that matters a lot. Thanks so much for talking with me.
I went back to Atlanta last week, and I hung out with my grandparents, and my grandma told me a fart joke, and she's 88, and I was like, cool, I don't have to grow out of that. Like, that's good to know. I can take that to the grave, just like my family will.
I love it. Happy grandma. That's awesome. Thanks so much, Phil. Have a great day, and we'll talk again.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye. Phil Guymon joined me from his home in California. PhilTheThrill.net is his website. Ask a pro. Deep thoughts and unreliable advice from America's foremost cycling sage. What a hoot. It's always fun to talk with him. And he's got these really cool cookie recipes, too. That's our show for this week. I want to thank Laura Everett, Caitlin and Chris from Verywall, and of course, Phil, for joining me. We have so much more in the pipeline for the Outspoken Cyclist over the next few weeks. It's going to blow you away. I hope you have a chance to go for a ride. See you next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.